From Iowa Public Radio News, this is The Exchange. I'm Alex Hoyer, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. During the first half of today's show, a conversation with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. He will be speaking in Iowa City on Friday. Smith is the former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. We'll talk about Hoover as an unconventional politician and current political trends. And in the second half of the show, a conversation about teen driving safety. Today, Governor Culver signed a bill requiring teenagers 17 years old and younger to wear a seatbelt in the back seat. Plus, Iowa ranks among the worst states in teen driving safety. We'll talk about ways to improve it. That's all coming up right after this news from NPR. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer, sitting in for Ben Kiefer. Later in the hour, a live discussion with Corinne Peek-Asa, the director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center. Iowa ranks among the worst states in teen driving safety, and we'll talk about ways to improve it. But first, a conversation with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith recorded earlier this week. Smith regularly provides commentary on C-SPAN and PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He is currently a scholar in residence at George Mason University in Washington, D.C., and between 1987 and 2001, Smith was the director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. He'll be speaking at the Iowa Memorial Union in Iowa City this Friday. I first asked Richard Norton Smith about why he calls Herbert Hoover an unconventional political figure.
Well, he's unconventional in a lot of ways. First of all, he certainly never thought of himself as a politician. He had never run for office before he became president of the United States, which is itself probably a cautionary tale. The fact is that the presidency is the most political of offices, and if you don't have that kind of experience, if you don't have that kind of temperament, then you're probably going to have some problems. Hoover came to the presidency by the most unconventional of routes. He was a mining engineer. Many believe the world's foremost mining engineer at the beginning of World War I. And he gave up his mining career to organize the world's first massive ongoing humanitarian relief campaign to keep the people of Belgium from starving to death. And he became one of the great heroes of the war, was acclaimed on both sides of the Atlantic, and held a number of positions, non-elected positions, which burnished his reputation. So he was, in many ways, swept into the presidency without going through all of the way stations that ordinarily are required of a president.
Mm-hmm. There was a community college here in Iowa that recently did the world premiere of a play about Hoover's time during the Boxer Rebellion with his wife, Lou. And what about that background as a mining engineer? Did it contribute at all to making him the president that he was?
Well, that's a very good question. Let me back up and sort of answer a question you didn't ask but implied. The fact that they were in Tientsin in the middle of the Boxer Rebellion, Hoover was without a doubt the most cosmopolitan of all of our presidents. By the time their son, Herbert Jr., was 5 years old, he'd been around the world 8 times because of Hoover's far-flung engineering enterprises. So this gave him an insight into the world. In some ways, he may have known the world better than he did, certainly American politics. Lou is an absolutely integral part of this story. They were very much a partnership, not a political partnership, but in every other sense of the word. You know, her story, I think, is still not terribly well known. But you asked something else.
How did being a mining engineer prepare or maybe not prepare him for the presidency?
Yeah, I think it's almost more not prepared. A mining engineer, yeah, I mean, something, and how an engineer's mind operates. I'll give you an example. Hoover was an evangelist of efficiency. I mean, he carried it to extremes that some of us might think of as absurd. During World War I, when he came home as Woodrow Wilson's food administrator, he asked his son, Herbert C. Hoover Jr., if he minded giving up his middle initial. And the young man said, no, but why? And his father explained, I have to sign my name several hundred times a day. And if I can drop the middle initial, I'll save X amount of time. Now, that's a window on how the engineer thinks. But that kind of severe rationality has very little to do with how the political mind thinks.
Mm-hmm. So Herbert Hoover had that unconventional background. He came to the presidency, and during his presidency, it was during the time of the Great Depression, he was definitely disliked by many people, people talking about living in their so-called Hoovervilles and using newspapers as Hoover blankets. What differences or parallels can be drawn from what took place in the 1930s to the recent troubles with the economy?
Well, it's an interesting question. In many ways, I think both the outgoing Bush administration and the incoming Obama administration wanted desperately to not to see history repeat itself. Neither one wanted to be a Herbert Hoover for the 21st century. And so they collaborated in many ways. And then basically threw everything but the kitchen sink when the credit crisis became dire. So in that sense, that's part of the Hoover legacy. Something else, though, that I think is relevant, we tend to think of the politics of personal destruction, the kind of relentlessly negative campaigning that has come to define much of our politics as a fairly recent development. In fact, one reason why Herbert Hoover for many, many years was seen as the personification of the Great Depression, why he became the face of economic paralysis, obviously to his regret, was because of a full-time, ongoing, very sophisticated public relations effort launched by his political opponents, and as well, frankly, by some of his own shortcomings. He was not a great communicator. You know, he was an Iowa Quaker. He once said he was 10 years old before he realized he could do something for the sheer pleasure of it without offending the Lord. And there's this kind of emotional, again, it goes back to what I said earlier about the way the engineer looks at the world.
But really, the way that he handled the tough economic times of the Great Depression was really not that unusual for that time, just letting the free market work itself out.
Yeah, but in fact, it was actually more than that. One reason why Hoover, in some ways, is a man without a party today. He represents very much a third way. You know, he thought the old notions of laissez-faire were dead and gone, or should be. At the same time, he vehemently opposed socialism as a great threat to what made America uniquely America. And so he, it's interesting, if you look at coverage in the New York Times in 1930, the American Federation of Labor at the same time praised Hoover for doing more in the initial wave of actions after Wall Street collapsed than any president before him. Traditionally, boom and bust were seen as acts of God. There was really nothing that the government could do. Hoover disregarded that in a number of ways. He took steps that were much more activist than his predecessors, but they appear in the shadow of the New Deal to be not nearly enough.
Mm-hmm. You've been the director of several presidential libraries, including the Herbert Hoover Presidential Site in West Branch, Iowa. From your experience, are people still visiting presidential libraries and museums?
They are. Absolutely they are. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but people don't get into station wagons the way they did 30 years ago and take the family on a 3 or 4 week summer vacation, stopping at a number of sites along the way. I think there are forces in our popular culture, how we live our daily lives, that that probably contribute to a long-term decline in visitation.
So what still draws people to go to these museums?
Well, I think, first of all, anytime you can put a human face on history, if you can personalize the past, if you can humanize it, And great museums do that, really good museums do that. And ironically, Hoover's story is one of the most dramatic, one of the most powerful roller coaster rides in American history. And I think the museum does a pretty good job of communicating both the highs and the lows.
You said that good museums really have to humanize people. How do you keep the museums interesting? Many of today's children and many adults probably expect interactive experiences.
Sure.
and high-tech exhibits now.
Well, you know, that's a very good question, and I think the time is at hand. I think there are some internal discussions that are going on, even as we speak, about what the next generation of exhibits at the Hoover Library might look like. But in the meantime, they do a lot of changing exhibits, temporary exhibits, which bring in a lot of folks who either have never been there or who might not make a repeat visit otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Given your experience and you're a presidential historian, can you pick maybe one or two presidential library and museums that really do an exceptional job?
Boy, you know, you know, it's a fair question. I'm not sure I want to alienate my former brethren. Certainly there are a lot of people who have been to the Lincoln in Springfield who come away wowed, precisely because of some of the things we've been talking about, because of the sophistication of the interactive exhibits, the visual element of a story and the like. And let's face it, it's the great American story. So, you know, the Lincoln, I think, is certainly at the head of the list. But, you know, each of these libraries has their own strengths. The F.D. Earn Library is the oldest and probably most in need of renovation. On the other hand, it was designed by the president. It's on his estate, next door to his home and his burial site. It's a uniquely personal expression of Franklin Roosevelt, and that makes it very special.
Mm-hmm. Switching to a completely different topic, President Obama is in the Midwest this week, coming right here to the state of Iowa, conducting what the White House calls a Main Street tour, where the president shares his ideas about growing the economy. Will his message, do you think, from here on out be about growing the economy and maybe reforming Wall Street?
Well, I think certainly the next few months leading up to the election, I think there is a very deliberate effort to shift the focus, with the health care plan having passed, onto somewhat friendlier terrain from the White House's standpoint. And the idea of Wall Street reform that you mentioned, I think, is part of that plan. And also, I think, to the degree that there was criticism during the first year, there was a sense on the part of some that the president was spending more time on health care, which to many people is an abstraction, than the immediate almost crisis of unemployment. Once the health care plan was put to bed, there was always going to be the shift back to bread and butter issues.
More of my conversation with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith coming up after this short break. We're back with The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Alex Hoyer. Ben Kiefer is back tomorrow. On tomorrow's program, a look at the Regents University's new sexual assault policy and what makes sexual assault on campus different than when it occurs in the larger community. Also, how much of the solution is found in educating victims about preventative steps to take, how much of it is changing campus culture. That's on The Exchange tomorrow at noon. Now, back to more of my conversation with presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. How do you think President Obama's victory with overhauling the healthcare system will affect his legacy?
It's hard to say in a sense because we don't know exactly how it's all going to shake out. On the other hand, we can say with some confidence that he has accomplished something that has eluded his predecessors for the better part of 100 years. And that is no small thing, particularly in a political climate where I think it's become harder for presidents of either party to accomplish big things. So, you know, there's no doubt that it makes him an important president. The jury is out, obviously, on how well it works and what its long-term consequences may be.
So is it really too early to start formulating what the Obama legacy may look like?
Sure it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There is the argument that America, immediately after President Obama took office, that it became a country that was center-left. Do you agree with that?
Well, I've written about that. I think basically, no, I don't. I think that the assumption was not only the president's election, but, you know, the very strong showing of Democrats in the last two congressional elections, and Bush fatigue, and also, let's face it, in January a year ago, there were a lot of people who believed that we might, in fact, be on the verge of a Great Depression. And so there was a sense on the part of many that Americans were turning away from the old unregulated, anything goes on, you know, in the marketplace notion of government's role. And we're expecting a much more hands-on or interventionist role by government. I think that the last year has called that very much into question. Part of the problem is that people on both the left and the right basically don't trust government, either to do the right thing or to do it competently. And so I think part of the challenge that the president faces is rebuilding a sense of confidence. And it won't be easy. As I say, it's a very, you know, we're going through a very bitter, very divisive time in the political culture of the country. And it's difficult to see how any president could forge a kind of consensus.
How do you think that the unprecedented, at least what seems unprecedented, levels of partisanship taking place, how do you place that in the context of American political history?
Well, there have certainly been times of immense partisanship and immense rancor. Let's face it, the pre-Civil War years, and for that matter, the post-Civil War years, we saw it at times during the Great Depression. We saw it in the lead-up to World War II. What is different, I think, about this is the technology, which in ways that are both subtle and profound, I think contribute to the ugliness of much of the political discourse. The Internet is a wonderful tool in the right hands, but it can also be a vehicle for rumor mongering and character assassination. And I think, you know, the blogosphere is less about persuading people than it is about dividing them. It's almost as if our politics have reached a point where there is a reward, not for narrowing our differences, but for exploiting them. And there are a number of factors that contribute to that. But I think cable TV is a significant part of this, and it's not a happy time for people who care about governing as opposed to political posturing.
Do you think this trend is going to continue?
It's difficult to see what reverses it. Remember, right after 9/11, it was tempting to believe, okay, we're going to get serious now. We're going to come together in the face of this unprecedented threat, and we're going to get real. And that didn't last very long.
You've commented before that the fringe of American politics is different than in years past. What do you mean by that?
Well, part of it is it's bigger. Part of it is it is also subtly affected by the coverage it receives. I want to be very careful in choosing my words here, because I think the Tea Party movement, in some sense, is a creation of the media. There is no doubt that there are millions of people who are unhappy with the course of Washington. In some ways, they recall to mind Ross Perot's followers in the early 1990s, who actually managed to put the whole issue of budget reduction onto the national agenda. And it's possible that history will repeat itself. But it is also true that television, and particularly cable television, is all about conflict, stoking conflict, promoting it. And often the way to get on TV is to say the most outrageous thing possible. So in that sense, the fringe is more complex and in some ways more worrisome, I think.
Mm-hmm. People who associate themselves with the Tea Party movement are often very careful to say that they are not a political party, that they are a movement.
I think that's a distinction without a difference. Because I don't question their sincerity. The problem is they're not in a position to decide that. The media, for example, will play a very large role in determining what their future is.
Is the landscape ripe for a third party?
I think it's ripe for a third party, but in perhaps surprising ways. I think actually it's ripe for a fourth party. I think that there are lots of people who are turned off to the two major parties. They're turned off to the political process as it has evolved. They would like to see us avoid what I call the politics of avoidance. You know, much of our politics has been trivialized, you know, over the last decade or more. And so I think they would like to see a party that is, in many ways, middle of the road, that is non-ideological, that is profoundly concerned with getting our financial house in order. I think there's room for that party, but I also think there's room for a fourth party, which might very well be an outgrowth of the Tea Party movement.
Do you think a third or even fourth party would be successful?
Well, history suggests it would not, in terms of winning and holding office. Now, in terms of affecting the national debate, that's where third parties can really have an impact. Again, I go back to Ross Perot. If Perot had not run in 92, it's not at all certain that Bill Clinton would have made debt reduction, you know, his first overriding priority.
What are you pursuing academically speaking now that is really interesting?
Well, I have been working for 10 years on a suitably epic biography of Nelson Rockefeller, and I think probably another couple years before that's ready to be published.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, is really a history of, in many ways, of not only American politics but American culture in the 20th century. It's a reason it's taking 10 years to do.
Mm-hmm. You'll be speaking in Iowa on Friday. Tell us a little bit about what you'll be talking about.
Well, Friday evening at the Student Union in Iowa City. Title of the talk is Why History Matters. And I guess I'll probably leave it at that. But in a hopefully entertaining way, talk a little bit about why history should be a part of our daily lives, why it shouldn't be relegated to the academic cloister, what it has to teach us, what it has to inspire us, and sometimes what it has to sober us.
All right. Richard Norton Smith, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Richard Norton Smith regularly provides commentary on C-SPAN and PBS's The NewsHour with Jim Lehrer. He's the former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch. He'll be speaking at the Iowa Memorial Union in Iowa City this Friday. Coming up on the program, a live conversation with Corinne Peek-Ossa, the director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center. Iowa ranks among the worst states in teen driving safety, and we'll talk about ways to improve it. This is Iowa Public Radio. I'm Alex Hoyer. We're back with The Exchange on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Alex Hoyer in for Ben Kiefer. This morning at Blank Children's Hospital in Des Moines, Governor Chet Culver signed a bill that requires teens 17 years old and younger to wear a seatbelt in the back seat. The current law requires passengers 10 and under to wear a seatbelt there. And in a story released last month by U.S. News and World Report, Iowa ranks the 49th worst of 51 states, including the District of Columbia, in teen driving safety. Joining me now to talk about today's news and ways to improve teen driving safety is Corinne Peek-Ossa. She is the director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Alex.
Okay, so starting with today's news, what is your reaction to this bill signing today that children up to the age of 18 are required to wear a seatbelt in the back seat?
Well, I think it's a very important step forward. One of the reasons Iowa ranks poorly as far as teen safety is that we have rather weak laws and policies about teen driving. And this is one loophole that was very important to close. So we're not done yet, but this was a very important step forward.
We have some audio from Iowa Public Radio reporter Janine Beck, who was at the governor's bill signing today. She spoke with Isaiah Kroll, a Shell Rock teenager who suffered a brain injury in a car accident in July of 2008. He was riding unbuckled in the back seat while traveling from field to field as he and his friends detasseled corn. Their car struck a bus, and he has spent the past year advocating for this legislation.
I'm extremely pleased. I worked for like a year on this bill. But I don't think this should be it. I think that it should be for everybody. But I'm happy that it's just for teenagers.
So that's Isaiah Kroll, a teenager from Shell Rock who suffered a brain injury. He was not wearing his seatbelt while he was in the back seat. Corinne Picasa, Isaiah Kroll says wearing a seatbelt in the backseat should be required for everyone. Do you agree with that?
I think Isaiah is right on with that, and he is such a wonderful advocate for this issue because he knows firsthand that you never know when the crash is going to happen. So even if, you know, your chances of being in a crash for any given mile is relatively low, it can happen any time. And based on how effective seatbelts can be in protecting the body in a crash, it is very compelling that everyone should be in a seatbelt.
So why do legislators just target teenagers? Is it because it's easier, because maybe they're not as active in politics, or some of them can't even vote, maybe?
I think that may be part of it, but from a statistical standpoint, it's the right thing to do because teens have the highest crash rates and the highest crash injury rates. So they are the most vulnerable of the drivers that we do need to focus on.
So the facts really do match what the law is doing.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Tell us your story about teen drivers. Is a cell phone ban for teens that we're going to be talking about in just a second and requiring them to wear a seatbelt, is that enough? What else should be done? Do you have a personal experience with a distracted teen driver, or have you been involved in an accident with one? Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. That's 1-866-780-9100, or send us an email at theexchange at iowapublicradio.org. Corinne Picasa, why typically do a lot of teens not wear a seatbelt?
Part of it is habit. And if parents and driving instructors, which they tend to, don't drill in teenagers' heads, you need to put on your seatbelt, it just becomes something you don't think about doing. And I think that if it's not part of the law, it doesn't have as much teeth for parents to talk about safety. One of the things we're doing at the Injury Prevention Research Center is a study working with parents of teen drivers and helping them learn communication strategies and skill-building safety behavior conversations that go beyond rules and regulations. So the parent can help the teen better motivate themselves to make safe decisions in the car.
So this really isn't all about what laws will pass, because you can pass as many laws as you want and they're not necessarily followed, although they studies prove that they do encourage people to follow proper safety. You mentioned parents. What are some other measures that can be taken?
Well, I think parents care a lot about their kids. They're very aware that driving is a hazardous event for teens. And so there are two general areas where parents need to be involved. And the first are the rules and restrictions about when and how teens drive the car. And that is something that parents get some help from graduated driver's licensing programs that phase in the types of driving conditions as teens learn to drive. Mm-hmm. But we know that teens don't always react really well to rules and restrictions. It's sort of their job as teens to rebel against those a little bit. So it's also very important for parents to talk about safety behaviors, to set expectations, and to try to self-motivate teens to understand their role in being responsible drivers. So it's the parent, it is the policy, it's the schools, it's teaching about peer influence, as well as the roadway. And in Iowa, we have enormous numbers of rural roads where we also know that there are higher crashes and injury crashes on rural roads. And the differential is even higher for teens. So there's environmental factors, there's policy factors, as well as behavioral factors.
Mm-hmm. You're the director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center. Talk a little bit more about the role of that center.
Yes, the center is one of nine funded throughout the nation by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we do research in injury prevention that's very broad. So that includes road traffic safety. It includes domestic and family violence, residential fire safety, drowning safety, occupational safety. So it's a very broad task. Because Iowa's teen driver rates are crash rates are high, that is an area that we do prioritize. Mostly, we do research to try to build the evidence, to evaluate programs, to design programs. But we do also do a lot of outreach. And so we are and have been involved in some of the coalitions that have tried to move our policies forward from a safety standpoint.
Okay. We have a call from Cody in Cedar Rapids. Welcome to the program, Cody.
Hi. How's it going?
Good. Tell us your story.
All right. I think it was, it'd be three marches ago now. My girlfriend and I were riding with one of my friends. We're all in our 20s. And my friend and I both had our seatbelts on in the front seat. My girlfriend was sitting in the back seat in the middle. We ended up getting hit head on by a semi in the middle of Oskaloosa. We were both going 35 miles an hour. My friend and I, who was wearing our seatbelts in the front seat, suffered nothing but a bruised chest, you know, from the seatbelt. And my girlfriend, however, flew up between us, hit her head at the top of the windshield, and slid clear down to the bottom of the windshield. And she left a bunch of skin and hair and everything in there. And I ended up having to drag her out of the car, and she's just covered in blood. And 3 years ago, she's still pulling out glass of her forehead, and she broke her right orbital, which is like the bone that sits right below your eye behind it, so there's nothing they can do about that. So I support the seat belts for all ages in the back seat. But then, on the other hand, my sister, about 5 years ago, was T-boned in a car. She was sitting in the back seat, and she had taken off her seat belt because she dropped her phone and was reaching down to get it and was T-boned and knocked over onto the other side of the car. They were T-boned by a car. They were crossing the interstate, got T-boned by a car going 70. Mm-hmm. And they said if she had been wearing her seatbelt, she would have been trapped in place and smashed. Mm. And all she suffered from that was a broken hip. But, you know, regardless, overall, I still think it saved more lives than anything.
Mm. Thank you for the call, Cody. Cody calling us from Cedar Rapids. Cody telling us a story, a very sad story, and they were all in their 20s. So this new law would not require those over the age of 18 to wear their seatbelt in the back seat. What do you think is the potential momentum to go further with laws like this?
I think we will not give up until we have everyone seated. And Cody, thank you so much for your story. I think because the age that you were in the crash would not have been under the law, it just makes it oh so much more important for you to speak up and tell people your story and to encourage them to wear seatbelts. So if we think about the crash you were in, and one reason the driver should care a lot about whether or not the backseat passengers are buckled, in addition to just caring very much about them and their well-being, is if her trajectory had been behind one of your seats, and so that her head had impacted your head, it could easily have been a very bad head injury for both of you. So what we do see in crash dynamics, especially that involve the front and back of the vehicle, is that passengers become airborne and they can collide with other people in the front seat, so become injury-producing vehicles within the crash. You know, I know nothing about the crash that your friend was in, who was told that she was better off without the seatbelt on. I know we hear that a lot. People are afraid the car is going to catch on fire, and so you have to be able to get out. When we look at detailed crash reconstructions, it happens, but it's extremely rare that collisions will. That you'll fare better in a collision without a seatbelt on.
I'm speaking with Corinne Peek Asa, the director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center. Among other things, the report from U.S. News and World Report that I mentioned at the top of this half hour gave Iowa a failing grade for teen driver's license laws and distracted driving or texting laws. As I said previously, 49 worst out of 51 states, including the District of Columbia. There was also a bill, in addition to this backseat seatbelt law that was signed earlier this year that bans texting while driving for everyone, except for professional drivers and emergency workers. But it also bans all cell phone use for teens until they get a full license, and that primarily affects those under 18. That law also takes effect July 1st. Corinne, how big of a step is this in improving teen driving safety?
Well, first, I have to address this ranking of 49th, because as they ranked it with just their limited criteria, they're right. But it ignores the good news that teen driving fatalities are down. They're down nationwide and they're down in Iowa. So I think, you know, that there have been some successful strategies, and we should be very proud of those and continue to support them. The cognitive psychology getting towards the distracted driving is showing that things like texting and talking on the cell phone require a different – the formation of a conversation outside of the context that you're in requires a different part of your brain to work. So it becomes a multitasking activity that our brains are just not very geared to doing. Now, if we want to oversimplify a little bit why teens are in more crashes – their brain development is very different, and we know teens are passionate, smart, energetic citizens, but their brain development is really much more active in the limbic system, which is the emotional system. And so when they're required to drive, which is a very cognitive function, the decision-making is drowned out by all the activity going on in their limbic system. So driving is somewhat counterindicated just based on the normal brain development of a teenager. When you add texting and conversation to that, it's even more of a mismatch between the types of areas in your brain that have to focus on driving and the parts of your brain that are active in the conversation and just being a normal teenager.
Mm-hmm. Tell us your story about distracted teen driving. Have you been involved in an accident with one? What were they doing at the time? Give us a call at 1-866-780-9100. That's 866-780-9100, or send us an email to theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Marjorie from Windsor Heights joins us now. Welcome to the program, Marjorie.
Good morning. This isn't about an accident, but this is about something we heard and read somewhere. This is not my home state. We used to live in several different states. The last one was Ohio. We read that they do not driving test everyone applying for a license, that they pick certain birth dates. Does the lady happen to know if that is true? Because if that is true, to us that was very shocking, because in Ohio everybody had to take all the young people, even though they took driver's ed, they had to take a driving test.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I taught all my kids how to make right turns to get where they wanted to go as much as possible.
yes, right turns are definitely better than left turns. Thank you for your call, Marjorie. Corinne, can you address that? Does Iowa require maybe just some birth dates after they pass?
It's a very good question, and I don't know the answer. It would surprise me, and I would hope it's not the case that every newly licensed driver is not subjected to a driving test. It does open also the question of driver's ed, because I think that what we find looking across the state is there's a huge variability in the quality and the amount of time and actual driving experience that students get. There is not a core curriculum for what students need to know or be able to do at the end of driver's education. So I think it's very important that parents don't assume that driver's ed is going to teach their child everything they need to know. It's very important to have supervised driving time. So I think that a parent probably shouldn't let their child go for the driving test until they've already passed the parent's driving test.
Mm-hmm. Where you've been talking a lot about parents' interaction with their children, where can parents go to find out more information about maybe how to talk to their child about this, or where they can just get more information about it?
So far, most of the research has really focused on driving contracts, and there are a number of those out. And those focus very much on the rules and restrictions, when should the child drive, that the parent and the child sign expectations that the child will always make safe driving decisions. There's been much less that's focused on communication strategies. So if simple searches of the net, of the web, insurance companies all have materials that focus on teen driving safety. There's much less about effective communication, and we're hoping hoping to make the program we're testing available on the internet very soon. When an Iowa teen gets their license for the first time, they should get a brochure from the Department of Transportation called You're the Coach, A Parent's Guide to Safe Teen Driving. That's also available on the internet, and that is a very good guide. So I think every parent should look for that. And then also think about some of the elements on a contract that you might sign with your teen.
Mm-hmm. What are the most common types of accidents that teens are getting in these days?
There's so many different issues. Again, looking at the roadway, rural roads in Iowa are a very big issue. And in a study we did, we looked at just the knowledge of teens on rural roads. And they would answer questions like, they agreed with questions, true, false, that you should speed up as quick as you can on gravel roads and brake quickly so you don't lose traction, which is the opposite of what you should do. But most of them answered yes. Questions about if there's a farm vehicle in the roadway, you should speed up and pass it immediately so you don't end up getting stuck behind it. And a lot of yes answers to that. So lack of knowledge, experience, and maturity are probably the main contributors to teen crashes. So intersections are problematic. Distraction is problematic. Not taking the role of driving seriously is problematic. It's hard to pin it down to one type of configuration because there's so many different things that go into it.
We have a call from Tommy in Mount Vernon. Welcome to you, Tommy.
Hey, guys. What's up?
Tell us your story.
Well, I don't really have a story. Well, first off, I'm a 19-year-old college student. I go to Cornell College. And you guys were talking about that seatbelt law. And now our guest here said that it's a good bill because it helps the most statistically at-risk groups demographic in the state. However, she also said there is a possibility of crash at any moment, and you need to be prepared at any moment for a crash. So if we need to be prepared at any moment for a crash, and a crash could happen to anyone, then why do we only have this bill for people under the age of 18? When people are driving on public roads, I mean, the government has the right to say, hey, you got to wear a seatbelt. So there's no freedom issues involved.
Okay, Tommy, I think we have your point. Thank you so much for the call today. Corinne, we sort of talked about this during when we first started having this conversation about why not everyone, but it's a good first step.
Yes, and Tommy, I think that is a question that you should pose to your legislature because it's exactly the question that we need to be asking. And it is, you know, this step was a long time in the making, and I just have to commend Blank Children's Hospital and the Department of Transportation for sticking with this and not letting it go. And so, you know, it will be a process to get everyone required to wear a seatbelt.
Jill in Polk City joining us now by phone.
Yes.
Yes. What do you have to say to us today?
I have a daughter who finished driver's ed a couple years ago and then one that's in it right now. And the kids only get tested by a driving instructor when they're getting their initial license. If their birthday happens to fall on the right day, or if the instructor they took driver's ed from recommends that they drive with a testing person. And that's it. And I would say most of the teenagers I know who've been through this did not end up having to take a driving test at the DOT.
So it can be based off of grades, maybe?
No, it's strictly a lottery birthday or whether you can pass the driver's ed, but the instructor can still say you need to be driving with a DOT person before you're allowed to get your license.
Interesting.
And coming from Illinois, where everybody has to have that at the age of 16, I think they're missing a lot of bad drivers out there.
Thank you for the call and helping us clear that up, Jill. Corinne
Picasa,
your center has been funding a study that utilizes a video surveillance system to monitor newly licensed 16 years old. What is that all about?
Yeah, we partially fund it. It's a study run by Dr. Dan McGeehee from the Public Policy Center. And it's a study that uses in-vehicle video camera technology as an intervention. So I think these types of technologies are fairly well known and they're on the market. They basically record a video clip every time the vehicle passes a certain acceleration or driving threshold. And then in Dan's study, the video clips that are recorded are downloaded to a CD, and the parents every week receive a report card as well as a CD with the video clips to go over what their teens are driving, how they're doing. And the initial evaluation results are very successful. We're excited because we're waiting for funding shortly to combine the programs where we have a parent-based strategy, because one thing we don't know from Dan's studies is whether or not the parents are using the videos, how much they talk to the kids about it, if they're successful in those conversations. So we want to merge the use of the technology with some strategies for the parents.
Mm-hmm. And really another way to bridge that gap between education and parent interaction.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So considering all the legislation that was passed this time around, is it enough? What is the next step?
The most important step on the near horizon are some enhancements to our graduated driving licensure system, where we are fairly weak. The other big safety issue is the school permit. We are one of only three states and the most liberal of those three states that allow children beginning at the age of 14 and a half to drive. It's supposed to be just to and from school, but it's not well enforced. And the presence of the school permit kind of opens the door for drivers of 14 and 15 all across the state. So when we look at crashes of 14 and 15-year-old drivers, maybe half of them are not licensed. So that's another big policy issue.
Mm-hmm. Great. Corinne Peek-Asa, Director of the University of Iowa's Injury Prevention Research Center, thank you so much for joining us
today.
Thank you. The Exchange is produced by Jeff Schmidt and Catherine Perkins, technical support from Dennis Reese, production assistance today from Christina Sarnelli and Janine Beck. Podcasting and on-demand audio from The Exchange is available by going to iowapublicradio.org, and we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. Contact us anytime via email at theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Alex Hoyer. Thanks for joining us.